All right, and we'll move on to the next case for this morning, which is United States against Grossman and the appeals of Aurora Loan Services, Wells Fargo Bank. Mr. Cameron?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm John Cameron. Joe Infante and I represent Aurora Loan Service, one of the appellants in this matter. Dante Stella represents Wells Fargo, and you'll be hearing from him a little later. This is a forfeiture case, but it's a very interesting forfeiture case because it involves issues of not only due process, but Michigan real property law. Nearly 20 years ago, Judge Cummings, writing for this court, noted that forfeitures of property are not favored in the law, and that the Seventh Circuit is sensitive to the mandate that requires the government to provide adequate notice to potential claimants in forfeiture proceedings.
I have a central question about this for you, Mr. Cameron, which is this. In your brief, at page 28, you mention this you have set out the basic recording statute that Michigan uses for this kinds of thing, and the list pendants should have gone into the Book of Levies, as I understand it. And then you cite 565.28, which is the one that refers to the alphabetical grantor-grantee index. And it seems clear that that this transaction, this list pendants, didn't go into the grantor-grantee index under a name that your client would have been looking for when it issued the note, the mortgage.
That's right.
The government, though, as I see the central difference between the two of you, it's whether that makes any difference. Because as I understand the government's position, the fact that the list pendants was recorded in the Book of Levies is enough. And this additional book, the index book, while perhaps a convenience, isn't enough to defeat the constructive notice from the Book of Levies.
Great question. May I address it at length, Your Honor?
It's what I'm interested in. My colleagues may be interested in something else.
But
thank you. First of all, we need to keep in mind that there's a basic precept of property law that if you're going to claim an interest in real property, it has to be on the record. You have to record it.
It's what record we're talking about.
Yes, sir, that's right.
Right, because and this is certainly in the Book of Levies, right? Mm-hmm. You would concede that much. Yeah.
It is in the Book of Levies, but interestingly, there's references in the record to its being placed in the entry book of levies. But that's not supported in the record. And the reason it's not supported on the record is that there is no entry book of levies in Van Buren County, Michigan. But I do concede that it is in a miscellaneous book of levies. Here's the point, though. When you look,
What's the difference between an entry book of levies and a miscellaneous book of levies?
An entry book of levies is where a notation is made of a document when it's presented to the register for recordation. And if you go into the register's office and look at an entry book, you can scan down the pages to see what it is that's been recently entered. A book of levies is just a book that has thousands, hundreds of thousands of entries going back to 1837 when Michigan was made a state.
Right, this is like the folio something or other, you know, book, right?
Yes, ma'am. What's critical to understand here is that the Michigan Recording Acts have to be considered as a whole, and you need to consider not only the statute, but how the Michigan Supreme Court has interpreted that statute. I believe you're bound by the determinations of the Michigan Supreme Court. And our Supreme Court has said that you need to put it on the record, but it also has to fall within the chain of title. That's the grantor-grantee index. That's MCL 565.28. It has to fall in the chain of title because if it doesn't, nobody could find it. And our Supreme Court has been very clear on that point. I'd like to read you what the Supreme Court says in a mortgage case. It says, for although the prior mortgage, the first one recorded, just like the list pendants was first recorded here, the prior mortgage might describe the same land. This one described the same land. Yet if it was executed by someone having no connection with the real title, but outside of the chain of title, it could in no way defeat the second recorded mortgage. The court goes on to say that it's therefore incumbent upon one claiming priority to show not only that it describes the land, but that it was connected with someone having title. That's at 28 Michigan 191, Your Honor. And that's good law today.
So basically your argument is that these cases that the government cites on page 34 of its brief, some of them are a little ancient, 1893, 1882, and 1880. Then we pop up to 1990. But these cases seem to indicate that as long as you have properly recorded it, by which I understand put it in the Book of Levies, they cite this 1882 case, recorded list pendants constitutes constructive notice even where it had been lost and not entered in the Recorder of Deeds file book. Those are, in your view, not good law in Michigan.
They're not good law on the point of whether it has to get in the chain of title. The Michigan Supreme Court has spoken, and it has never overruled that pronouncement that it made so many years ago. And property law is ancient law. That's the nature of real estate law in Michigan and other states. And a lot of these cases the government cites and that we cite are old, but our cases are still good law. There's something else to consider here, too, when you're looking at this whole concept of notice and would a person have discovered this notice. Number one, if you look carefully at the cases cited by the government, looking beyond the headlines to the nuances, you will see that there's a thread running through all those cases. Either the person whose interest is sought to be attacked is named and is found in the Grantor-Grantee Index, or in some of the cases that aren't Michigan Supreme Court cases, there's a tract index where the property description will lead you, by looking at a tract index, to find the notice. In this case, there was neither. There was no tract index, and it's not in the chain of title.
Well, because Betty, had the government filed this list pendants, Betty Grossman as nominee for Jeffrey Grossman, we wouldn't be here, right?
Yes, ma'am. We wouldn't be here today. If they had only gone through the process of naming her as nominee, we wouldn't be here. In addition, our recording acts, again, they have to be read as a whole, provide something for the government to take advantage of in a case like this. If you look at MCL 565.451A, you will find that our legislature has given claimants like the government an opportunity to record an affidavit. An affidavit in this case would say, gee, we're seeking to forfeit Jerry Grossman's interest in the house, but either we're saying Betty's a nominee, or we think that maybe he's got the whole interest and Betty doesn't have any. And we filed a forfeiture in the District Court for the Northern District of Illinois. And you all better take notice that our affidavit is telling you that this is on the record. There was a remedy there for them to take advantage of under our recording statutes, and they didn't do that.
And so it's also your position, is it, that even though he was listed in the mortgage papers as a mortgage holder, that was not sufficient?
He was listed in the mortgage
papers?
Wasn't
he listed in the mortgage papers as a mortgage holder?
I can't answer that question, Your Honor. I don't know. If you say it was, I'm sure it was.
Well,
I don't know that.
That's the question I have.
But as a mortgage holder, that would not get into the chain of title.
That still wouldn't. That would be irrelevant.
No,
as well.
That would be irrelevant to the chain of title. Just as in one of the cases cited by the government, it was noted that the mortgage was properly recorded, even though the mortgagee was not named. That mortgagee wasn't in the chain of title, and therefore it didn't it didn't fall within the rule.
So what are we to make of this affidavit from Mr. Smith that there is no tract index in the particular county, Van Buren County, Michigan? I take it that was furnished by you after the hearing before Judge Bucklow?
That was furnished by the counsel for Aurora at that time, Mr. Villa, to Judge Bucklow to demonstrate. Because Judge Bucklow had said in an earlier hearing something like, you mean they just couldn't find it? And Mr. Villa said, well, that's right. And he brought the affidavit in to show the court that though it was recorded with a property description on it, there is no way to search property descriptions at Van Buren County. That's an optional way of a county providing a method of searching in Michigan, and not all counties have them.
Because Magistrate Judge Denlow had assumed that there always would be a tract index, I think.
Yes, he did. And unfortunately, I wish we did have tract indexes in all counties, Your Honor, but we don't in Michigan. Only some do. And I want to note very carefully that the two cases cited by the government, contrary to our position, the two more recent cases, the Shupke case in the Michigan Court of Appeals and the Cipriano case in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan, both involve counties where there were tract indexes. That's different than what we have here today.
So Van Buren County must be relatively rural. This was a vacation house?
Yes, ma'am. Van Buren County is on the west side of Michigan. The Register of Deeds is in Paw Paw, Michigan.
Okay. All right, because the other point, I guess, from a legal point of view that your argument depends on is how one reads 565.29. Because as you've quoted it in your brief on page 29, you indicate it says essentially subsequent conveyances that are not recorded as provided in this chapter. And you read as provided in this chapter to mean both in the appropriate book, you know, book of sale, book of levy, book of whatever, and the index book.
That's right, Your Honor. Regrettably, our Michigan Recording Acts are not models of clarity. And so we need to look to not only the words of the statute, but how the courts interpret the statute. And as I mentioned a minute ago, the Michigan Supreme Court has very clearly said that to complete the act of recording, to provide something as constructive notice to a subsequent owner or mortgagee, it has to get in the chain of title. And that's the law in the state of Michigan, and that's what didn't happen here. And again, if there had been a tract index, we wouldn't be here today. If they had filed an affidavit, we wouldn't be here today.
Well, if all of those things had happened and your client is a bona fide purchaser, you would have spotted the list pendants and you might not have issued the mortgage, right?
Well, I think that's exactly right. If one of the things that happened to alert us that they were claiming her interest in her house, not her husband's interest, which he didn't have any interest because he didn't record any interest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
May I take a minute and address the due process aspects of the case as well?
Sure.
Just very quickly before we run out of time, I'd like the court to be well aware of the fact that these due process issues were raised repeatedly in the proceedings below. The government suggests that somehow this was waived because it wasn't raised, but if you look at the transcript of the magistrate's hearing, it's on page 6, page 7 and 8, page 24, page 35, page 36, and page 48. If you look at the March 10 hearing before Judge Bucklow, it's raised on pages 23 and 24. And if you look at the March 31 hearing before Judge Bucklow, it's raised on pages 10, 11, 13, and 15. And we believe that that is more than adequate to show that that matter was raised, it was preserved, and we believe that we're entitled to a reversal here as a matter of law. This notice was no good, and Aurora and Wells Fargo have perfected interest in this collateral that should be recognized by the court as absolute. But at a bare minimum, under the Pacheco case in the Second Circuit, we're entitled to a hearing to determine what interest they claim in this home.
Now, just to clarify one final point, under 853N6, which is the forfeiture statute, it seems to me you're either under subpart capital B or not in at all, the bona fide purchaser. You're not arguing anything other than bona fide purchaser, are you?
Under the statute, Your Honor, we're arguing bona fide purchaser, but let me note that there is an overriding due process question here as to whether he had any interest in the home at all. And if he has no interest, then there's nothing to attach.
Right. That strikes me, honestly, as a weaker point of yours, because it looks like, at least from the record, the underlying criminal record, that he was funneling this ill-gotten money over to his wife and building this house and doing all sorts of other things, which makes me think of, you know, equitable interests or constructive trusts or some such thing.
It's possible, and that's why there'd need to be a hearing. May I alert the court to one other thing very quickly, and then I'll sit down? I was reluctant to raise this, but I want to raise it. Recognizing that in the Humphreys case this year, you all acknowledge that there are some circumstances where justice requires consideration of something not in the briefs. There's an Eighth Circuit court opinion called 7725 Unity Avenue, 7725 Unity Avenue, 294, Fed 3rd, 954. That case establishes in the Eighth Circuit, and according to the Eighth Circuit and two other circuits, something called the innocent lien holder defense under forfeiture cases. And it says even if you're junior to the government, even if your mortgage is recorded after a government's list pendants, if you as a lender were not associated with the crime, then you as an innocent lien holder are entitled to be secured for the proceeds of your loan. When you tie that to 853J in the statute we're dealing with here in this case, it's so important that it's something that I wanted to call the court's attention to and at least invite you to look at it. And thank you. I'll defer now to Mr. Stella.
Mr. Stella, the obvious question for you is why weren't you too late?
Because we didn't know about it, Your Honor.
How could you not have known about it? Weren't you served by the government along with Aurora?
Your Honor, there are two questions with service. One is how something is served, and the second question is what is served. And in this case, what was served identified an interest that our bank did not hold. And that is the essence of the Estevez case that this court decided 19 years ago, namely that if you don't know that it's your interest being attacked, the time for your petition starts running, or in that case, the time for a Rule 60 motion would begin running when you do know about it. And under Estevez, as we believe it should be in this case, when the party did not then know that it was his specific interest being attacked, the court then looked to the facts of when that party did know.
But didn't the notice have the house by description, address, PIN number, et cetera, all sorts of ways that Wells Fargo, at least, being better than Van Buren County, could have looked through its records and seen, yes, we have an interest in this thing?
Your Honor, banks operate under state law, which works against individual interests. And drilling down to the bottom of this case, that is the criminal complaint and the fourth superseding information, the only thing that someone would see is that Jeffrey Grossman's interest was being attacked.
But there's an address. I mean, wouldn't you, do you not keep track in the bank of the properties in which you have an interest?
Your Honor, the bank keeps track of the interests in particular properties which it holds.
And what about the PIN number? I mean, that was listed in the notice you received as well, right?
Right, but
and that's a very simple thing to just run the PIN number.
Your Honor, the PIN number ties into the affidavit from Van Buren County indicating that there wasn't a way to look things up by the PIN number, and at any rate, it's not an official system of identification under Michigan law.
But that's what I'm asking about the bank. I mean, the bank has no internal records that keep – you don't have any list of the properties that the bank has some kind of lien on or other interest in?
The bank would have a record that it had a mortgage from Betty Grossman.
But no record anywhere in Wells Fargo Bank of the, organized by property.
Your Honor, that would be the subject of a factual hearing and discovery, and we believe that that's why this case should be remanded, is so that we can explore that issue.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. McNiven?
May it please the Court, my name is Carolyn McNiven, and I represent the United States in this matter. And if I may just jump to answer some of Your Honor's questions of prior counsel. First of all, Mr. Grossman, Jeffrey Grossman, was listed as a mortgagee prior to the Aurora Loan Service and Wells Fargo Bank loans.
But a mortgagee, at least your opponent says, doesn't make any difference. Mm-hmm. That's just some financial document. That's not something that would be picked up as a grantor-grantee kind of title interest.
I appreciate that. Of course, we believe that it's irrelevant whether or not it was in the grantor-grantee index. And I, but that just to answer
we'll
your narrow
that in a minute. But okay, yes. That's fine. So
answer your narrow question. He was. The second thing is with respect to the affidavit of Smith, which was coming late to the proceedings as it did. Mr. Smith did say that it was perfectly capable of running a PIN number, which is a property identification number, through the computerized system. What we effectively have, Your Honor, is a body of law that grew up around paper, books of levies, the large folios that Your Honors have mentioned a moment ago, and now we are in the age of computer. Mr. Smith, who is their affiant, said that it is now possible prior to a time, I believe it's October of 2000, that you're able to search the database by PIN number.
But he also said, did he not, in that section of the affidavit, that, quote, this office does not promote or otherwise identify to the public the existence or availability of this particular software function. So even though he secretly, on his own, may have been able to do that, if he wasn't making that a service available to the public, how would Aurora have known about it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the question is one of promotion, and I think that the people who run it are the...
promote or otherwise identify to the public.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's in the record, but I don't like to comment outside the record, but I believe title companies routinely download that information.
Well, that's not what his affidavit says, so I guess I'm a little concerned about relying on this alternative system.
And I certainly appreciate the honor, but we believe that Michigan law is clear. It's a race notice statute. We filed what, to preserve the government's interest, which arose before Betty Grossman took title of the property. We filed in compliance with Michigan law.
Not before Betty Grossman took title. You mean before the lien from Aurora?
No, I mean both. The government's interest arrives at the time of the crime.
Though the government's, you're saying the government's interest arose before Betty had it, but you didn't file the list pendants much later.
That's correct. To preserve that interest that previously arose. That is correct.
But the problem I have with your position, aside from just working one's way through the Michigan statutes as we were just trying to do, is that it does seem that the government is relying on a system of constructive notice, number one, that will not translate into real notice without, even with a very diligent search, without, because you're willing to say there's no index that would ever get you to the filing.
I'm not willing to say that, Your Honor.
Well, but in this instance, there is no grantor-grantee index isn't going to do it because Betty Grossman is the name in there, not Jeffrey Grossman.
Yes, that's what they've asserted.
Not that unusual last name.
That's what they've asserted, yes, Your Honor.
Well, okay. Yeah.
And then should the title searchers have to flip through the Book of Levies itself, all 1,300 volumes? I mean, that's not reasonable.
Well, Your Honor, if that's what the Michigan statutory system has provided as constructive notice, and we complied with that, I mean, the practicality here is that nobody goes through those. They go through various indices. Do they go through the grantor-grantee index, or do they actually download something on their computer live as it comes online?
Well, doesn't constructive notice mean notice of things that someone could actually find if they looked?
I don't know that it's actually, in fact, been defined that way by the Michigan Court, Your Honor, although that seems like a common-sense way of looking at it. We would say that,
well,
yes, you could find it. Well,
the Supreme Court of Michigan some common sense and go from there.
I agree. But the Supreme Court of Michigan has also said that if the notice gets filed in the wrong book, for example, or gets lost, that the fact of the recordation is what establishes the priority for purposes of the race notice statute. And they have said that, and they said that since the case that was cited by counsel.
Since your 1880 case. But then there's this statute that does require each register of deeds to keep a proper general index. And there's this other statute that says that a bona fide purchaser can claim if the conveyance hasn't been recorded, quote, as provided in this chapter. And this chapter includes both the indexing section, 56528, and the basic recordation section, 56525.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why you say under that statutory scheme only 0.25 counts, not 0.28, is unclear to me.
Well, I believe that 0.25 is the one that applies for determining superiority of interest. 0.28 does not. It establishes a system. It puts a burden on the recorder of deeds.
Well, I understand that's the way you would like to construe it, but all I want to say is 0.29, which seems to pull them all together, just says, every conveyance of real estate within the state hereafter made, which shall not be recorded as provided in this chapter, shall be void as against any subsequent purchaser in good faith and for valuable consideration. So if recorded as provided in this chapter means only 0.25, then I think the government's right. If recorded as provided in this chapter means both 0.25 and 0.28, then they're right. In brief, I mean, it seems to me it gets down to that.
Well, I guess I don't accept the second part of that, Your Honor, with all due respect. I think that you have to look at, first of all, it's not a conveyance. We're establishing that we have a claim of a right to something, which is different than a conveyance. The second thing is that I think that it has to, if you're talking about looking at something in the totality, you have to look at when they make a reference to a Liz Pendens, then what does the Michigan statutory scheme say about what a Liz Pendens has to put in? And we complied with that.
You're not at all concerned about the scenario where, you know, Jones is the owner of the property, and that's the grantor-grantee, and the government for some reason thinks that Smith has a real interest in the property, and so some innocent bank out there is trying to decide whether to extend a mortgage and perfect a security interest and all the rest in the property, and they do a diligent title search and not a word comes up about Smith, and then the government comes in and says, oh, we're just kidding, you know, we're going to take it away from you. That's a troublesome scenario that you're arguing for.
I think, though, that, Your Honor, that scenario would be addressed differently here. And let me just explain. For example, the idea that the government would have a criminal defendant, for example, agree to forfeit something that that criminal defendant does not own. And then we would wait. You know, that's essentially the going down, following along your hypothetical, and then we have the true owner coming in, be the true owner, not a bona fide, the true owner of that property coming in and filing an ancillary petition and making a vermence of fact showing that they in fact own, that they have a superior interest to that criminal defendant.
But the criminal defendant here basically just says, you can take what I have. He's not really taking much of a position about who really owns the property. And if in my hypothetical, Jones is the brother-in-law of Smith or something. People have different last names all the time, and they're related to each other. And so you wouldn't necessarily know, even with different last names. You could have complex situations where criminals are sub rosa, you know, funneling money in certain directions. But I'm worried about the outside bank who isn't going to be able to tell the difference between that situation and one where it really is a perfectly bona fide deal.
I don't disagree with that, but what I believe you can say is in the case where you have somebody who is the owner and they come in and they say, here's the basis for my ownership that is superior to the defendant's from which your government claim follows. Here we didn't have that.
But why are you focusing on the owner who has really dropped out of the case at this point? She's quit-claimed whatever she has to the government. You're trying to impose a large portion of this loss on the bank, which extended money in a loan secured by this property, and you want your interest to be superior to their interest in the property. If it weren't for the government coming in, they'd be able to foreclose if these people are in prison or otherwise unavailable to pay the loan, right?
If they haven't paid and we didn't exist, that's correct.
Right. So, in other words, this is about you and the bank, an innocent third party. You're not claiming the bank was in cahoots with Mr. Grossman or Mrs. Grossman or anybody. I haven't seen that in your papers.
We're not claiming that they were in cahoots, Your Honor. We're not claiming that they had some kind of conspiracy going on.
But they're a bona fide extender of credit, and the question is, are they bona fide enough? Is the without notice part satisfied enough that they should be able to enforce their interest, or is the fact that this is tucked away, you know, in folio 1,292, you know, enough to make the government's interest superior?
And, Your Honor, may I just address a few different things on a few different levels with that. First of all, although it's the big bad government coming in and seizing property, the government has announced its intention to take any monies that it gets in this forfeiture and pay it over to the victims of the original crime. In other words, the proceeds of the original crime that flowed purchase, construct, and so forth, this entity. So the real question there is,
could you go to some person on Michigan Avenue and say, we have some victims of crime, we've decided to take some of your money to reimburse them? I mean, you don't do that, right? You can only acquire funds to reimburse the victims from a legitimate source.
And that is correct. But the other side of that coin is, what is the government to do to preserve whatever interest is existing of the defendants, of the governments, in that property?
And the government failed to look enough into Mr. Grossman's interests to indicate Mrs. Grossman as a potential nominee.
No, Your Honor, I believe that it set forth in the superseding indictment exactly the basis for that. In fact, we set out our intention to forfeit the defendant's interest in real property, which interest included that parcel of property.
But you didn't. You're being picky, and I mean the list pendants doesn't mention her name. You didn't take the step when you filed the list pendants of revealing to the world at large in Michigan that her interest might get swept into this, perhaps for entirely valid reasons. You know, I'm not worrying about that, you know.
Your Honor, that's correct. Our list pendants did not contain her name. But I will say that the record is also replete with the fact that these lenders were very aware of Jeffrey Grossman. In fact, Wells Fargo Bank had Jeffrey Grossman at the closing signing the closing documents. So for them to say that they were unaware of him is, I think, disingenuous.
Yeah, but that's the assumption that the person who's going to search the record was the person sitting there at the closing. I mean, you're making that assumption that the banks had to know that Jeffrey Grossman was, you know, related to Betty Grossman. And you're saying that just because they were there when the signing occurred, then they should have known when this list pendants got filed to make the connection. You don't even know that the same people are searching the documents.
I do not know that.
So see,
I do
when,
not know
when this
that.
Kind of notice
Absolutely.
Comes in, usually it's a clerk of some kind that is looking at this information, searching to see if there's anything. Normally the people who are dealing with the mortgage signing are not there.
And Your Honor may be correct.
Or there's no evidence, let me put it that way.
Yeah, Your Honor, that is correct. I mean, I'm not going to say that it's going to be the same person, nor have I said that. But, I mean, there is the Michigan's race notice statute. The Michigan Supreme Court has repeatedly and continually for the last, 100, 150 years, said that although they're harsh results, and they're harsh results for lenders, they're harsh results for other people, the bottom line law. So if somebody loses it, if it doesn't end up in the book of levies, if there's, I presume, a flood or a fire, the act of the recordation is sufficient. Now, I appreciate there's a practical consequence that if we had said in there, mm-hmm. Betty Grossman is nominee on the face of the list pendants, we would not be here today. But that does not mean that what we needed to do that,
well,
nor does that mean...
I'm still having a problem with she's not named in the grantor-grantee index. There's no track index, and the PIN index is kept quiet. So, I mean, there's really no way that the banks could have known. Unless they, because they didn't, you didn't serve them with the superseding indictment, did you? Where it was mentioned that she held the property and that he, there was nothing about, the fact that it was really the proceeds from his fraud that built the house they both lived in. I mean, is her name even in the superseding indictment?
No, she's referred to as his wife.
You're right. So she's
That's
not
correct.
Named as, a co-conspirator or anything like that. I'm just saying that
right.
wasn't served on them at any rate.
That's
right?
correct. Although, to be fair to the record, I mean, the list pendants was found by the title company. It was found after the closing. And it was found because of the lag in the computer uploading system.
Mm-hmm.
To be fair to the government, we put out there something that was in fact found. And then we believe that what would a reasonable person under those circumstances do, finding a list pendants that asserted that a criminal defendant who was not the title holder, what should a reasonable person have done? A reasonable person who's thinking of lending money would go to the criminal file, although her name is not in there. She is not
that's
named.
Well, that's
and,
then,
and, then, and then give me the timing of that. You're saying it was ultimately found. Just remind me of the timing of when it was ultimately found in relation
I believe
to
it was a week or two after the closing, Your Honor.
Yeah.
So they are already under a legal obligation. And what I'm worried about is two more things. One, your opponents are mentioning this Michigan case, which they have discussed in their briefs, about the necessity of the chain of title being respected. which the grantor-grantee index will do. And secondly, the two more recent cases that you cite in your brief, 1990 and 1921, if we can call that recent, are both cases where there was a tract index. So I'm not sure that you're right, that Michigan law itself is quite as harsh as you're saying.
Well, Your Honor, may I just say that the Graves case is an example of a much more recent decision where we do have a situation where it was literally hours before one thing was recorded and then the mortgage interest came in. And in that case, the Michigan Supreme Court was invited by one of the parties and an amicus to follow this grantor-grantee index argument. They declined to do that. Had they done it, it would have been dispositive. It wasn't
sure
an amicus. One of the parties Your Honor. I beg your pardon.
No, go ahead.
One of the parties advanced that argument. So it wasn't just in the amicus. It was one of the parties. If it was the
tea leaves, though. I mean, they don't really have a discussion of it in their opinion.
Well,
Your
Honor,
a negative inference that you're drawing from lack of a different result.
Correct. But if it was so clear that this was a basis, I mean, it was dispositive, then you would think that the Michigan Supreme Court would say something about it if it was so clear. I mean, I think that the law as written in the statutes is that race notice is provided by constructive notice. We may think that things should be different, but the Michigan statutes are very clear here.
Well, and I guess, as Judge Williams said, part of the question is whether constructive notice can mean no notice whatsoever. I think even back to cases like Mullane against Central Bank of Hanover, where the Supreme Court has said that constructive notice has to be the best you can manage under the circumstances, and I know the context is a bit different. Let me ask you a quick question. Your opponent mentioned this Eighth Circuit case, 7725 Unity Avenue, and this apparently is new. Is this something that you have thought of? Do you want an opportunity to look at this and have both sides give us, you know, a short letter in a few days, or...
Yes, Your Honor, it is not something that I have thought of. It was not cited in their briefs, and I haven't had an opportunity to even review it.
Well,
so I don't know if it's relevant.
I would suggest that both parties within 10 days of today give us just a letter briefly discussing this so that you'll have an opportunity to say whatever you would like to about this innocent lien holder defense.
And if I may, Your Honor, just mention about the due process argument. The due process argument, when we were in front of the magistrate judge was concerned. Is this something that should go to summary judgment, or is this something that's capable of being dealt with on a motion to dismiss? And the counsel for both petitioners at that time said it was absolutely capable, this question of priority was capable of being determined on a motion to dismiss level. So we do say that now their request for having a hearing to somehow partition the interests is inapplicable. And then finally, with respect to the Wells Fargo being late, Your Honor, Wells Fargo Bank was given actual notice, and for them to say that they didn't understand that it affected their interests in the property is we think a stretch, given that we're saying that he had an interest in the property, which we believe is a red flag altogether. When you say that somebody who isn't title holder has an interest in the United States government attempting to seize that. So if Your Honors have no further question, I would just ask that you affirm the district court's granting of the motions to dismiss in this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I'll try to be very brief, Your Honor. Just a few concluding remarks. First of all, as to the Graves case, I was the one who filed the amicus brief in that case, and I actually appeared in the Supreme Court and presented the argument on the point. Regrettably, the Michigan Supreme Court did not address it. The Supreme Court seemed to be more concerned about purchase money mortgages, and I think if you look at page 49 of the record before the magistrate, you will see that Ms. McNiven agrees that the court neither specifically accepted nor specifically rejected it, and that the court in Graves went off and decided the case separately. Graves just doesn't apply here. Let's keep in mind that we're talking about a race notice statute, as the government has pointed out. It's not just the race, it's the notice. And as Judge Cummings noted in Estervetz almost 20 years ago, where you're dealing with forfeitures, the concept of notice is critically important. is particularly important here where the government could have avoided all this. There were several mechanisms available. They elected not to take advantage of them. And an innocent lender like Aurora should not be penalized for what the government failed to do. Thank you for listening to our argument this morning, and we ask that the court reverse the decision of the district court and declare that Aurora is entitled to a first mortgage position on this property. Thank you.
All right. Thanks to both counsel.